sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
A weekend with snooty baristas. Employment still the bright spot. Unintended consequences, and our guest, famed investor Jim Rogers. All this and much more on episode number 424 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, welcome to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Thanks for joining me. Andrew Horowitz here. And I want to thank everybody for sending me some emails on what we have been talking about in the office about the nice nomination we got for the best business podcast. And that was on, I guess it was last week. There was some kind of an awards ceremony that was with Stitcher, and Stitcher gave out some awards. I don't think we actually got the award, but we were in the top five or so for best business podcast out there. And there's some great other names that were also on the nominations. I didn't see the final, so maybe somebody could send me who won the final on that. But the bottom line is, I didn't know about it really till last weekend anyway. So that's great to hear. I appreciate it. And thanks for all of you for telling me about that. And we do have a lot to talk about this week and a great guest coming up in just a couple of minutes. This weekend, I went over to South Beach. I got a great deal on a hotel, summertime deals in South Beach, Florida, Miami Beach. And we stayed down there for a night or so and went to the beach, did a few things. Sunday morning, I wandered off and decided to get a cup of coffee. The only thing I could find was a Starbucks. You know, I'm not a real big fan of Starbucks, but nonetheless, I went into the Starbucks and asked a couple of questions. And the baristas were like, oh my God, you don't know what this is? You don't know what that is? I said, I'm just asking a couple of questions. Like, everybody has to know all about what Starbucks offers, what they have, and all the different varieties of food, coffee, cold, hot, teas, everything that's on the menu you should know about because, of course, it's Starbucks, of course. Kind of pissed me off. Very disappointing. I was kind of at a point where, wow, is this what it's come to? That the Starbucks barista believes that Starbucks is such an important icon in the coffee world, like which it is, of course, but to a point that everybody has to know at this point. And if you don't know, you're just, oh my God, go away, little man. You don't know what this is? So I figured I'd get him back a little bit. And as I put my order in for a iced coffee and another hot coffee for my wife, he said, as they always do, okay, well, what's your name? I got to put on the order. So I said, my name? Duncan. Just to kind of hopefully tell him that I was a little bit agitated with his attitude. But I do wonder what this means for Starbucks in the long haul, or for maybe just a one-off. Have you had that experience? Have you walked into a Starbucks and they think that they're all that, all about, wow, this is, we're Starbucks and, you should really know us and love us and revere us. I'm not a big fan of the coffee. Really not. Find it to be bitter and burnt for the most part. And very much a fan of, well, I guess probably Vietnamese coffee, and I like Cuban coffee to a point. It's a little bit over roasted as well, but nonetheless. Starbucks, great company though. Can't take anything away from the company. As a matter of fact, their growth has been spectacular. Their ability to grow from within, from new products, from new design, obviously, and from adding on and bolting on acquisitions like their tea acquisition that they did some time ago, as well as to spread the word and almost in an evangelical kind of way, to produce a great following for themselves. I mean, just an impressive company. As a matter of fact, so impressive, they're in our portfolio for our clients. But that doesn't mean I have to like the coffee. I want to talk about also a couple of different things that are going on. We'll get right to our guest. I'll come back. I want to talk about some economics and some things that are happening with what we saw last week, some market issues, a little bit about China. And a stock that I want to talk to you about that I found kind of interesting. on some of the action last week, and we have to kind of maybe dig out some questions as to what's going on there, but maybe there's an opportunity. But the employment, we'll talk about that a little bit. We did see a nice number last week with the continuation of about plus 200,000 over the 200,000 mark for new hires, for additions to payrolls, and an unemployment rate of about 5.3. That was good. We did see employment numbers, the wage numbers, though, from the employment report. I still wondering and scratching my head why it is that we're not seeing a tremendous amount, or at least a beneficial amount, of wage growth. And that leads me into the story of what's going on with Walmart. There was a really interesting piece on Bloomberg this weekend and over the weekend about how there's this kind of an unintended consequence, maybe even a backfire, with regard to the minimum wage boost that was given to many of the Walmart employees early in this year. Remember that, when that happened? The whole idea was to really improve morale. I guess they were hoping to retain employees. They were hoping to change the dynamic of what was a quote-unquote Walmart employee and what they should expect and why it's such a great place to work and why you want to work there. Well, it seems that this policy of increasing the minimum wage is having quite an opposite effect of what it was intended to do. One of the things that's happening is that many workers are very disparaged. They're very upset right now that, wait a minute, I didn't get a raise. There are people that have been working here for less time, who have less responsibilities, and all of a sudden they're making much closer to what I make because of this wage hike. And there's a lot of bad blood with that, and there's a lot of concern about, hey, why is it and how is it fair that just the average worker that just started, or maybe a worker that maybe started in the same position I had, let's say a year ago, 2 years ago, whatever the number is, it's all of a sudden getting a similar pay. That doesn't seem to be very fair. So there's this real concern inside of Walmart into morale and what's happening with the relationship of employee to employee, and how many are looking at this as a real negative. Now, on DH Unplugged, we talked about a similar situation to this, a little bit different, but similar, in that there was a company whose CEO was making like $900,000 a year, and his employees were making a lot less, and he decided that he wasn't going to take a pay raise at all. As a matter of fact, he was going to take his pay down significantly and give every single employee $70,000 per year of salary. And he thought that, hey, that's going to be great. That's going to give a lot of incentive. That's going to provide a tremendous amount of love for my company. That's going to give a lot of people who were struggling to make ends meet, you know, a much better opportunity. And therefore, what's going to happen is it's really going to be a big boost for my company and for productivity. Well, what happened there was two things. First, the guy is in all sorts of financial trouble right now because he doesn't have enough money to make ends meet in paying his house and a few other things. Okay, but skip that for a second. That's important. But the other thing, very similar to what happened here at Walmart, is that many people who did not get a raise, because let's say they were making $90,000. So they look at the person who was making $40,000, who's making now $70,000, and they're pissed. Hey, wait a minute. They were making this much. They almost got a double in their pay, and I'm still at the same pay rate that I got before. How is that fair? So this situation where you had this big, you know, uproar that has been going on about income and wage disparity, and now the catch-up that's going on is now irritating some of the higher-paid workers because they feel that it's not fair that they're not getting a raise or at least a substantial amount of increase that's commensurate with the amount that the lower-paid employees were getting before. And the big question remains, is this something that's going to actually increase productivity in companies, or is it going to create a lot of internal strife and aggravation to a point where productivity goes down and could be negative to those companies that actually abide by this or that go along with a voluntary level of minimum wage increase or a wage increase to begin with on a very broad-based concept, you know, on a very broad-based measure? There's something to think about. I thought it was a really interesting story that was coming out, and this is the second thing that we've seen related to the whole concept of wage disparity and trying to equalize the disparity and to bring it much closer, and how it's having a negative and unintended consequence than was thought. And I can see that. Tell me what you think. If you want to send me an email about that, tell me what you think. Send it to askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And maybe we'll read some of those results on the next or an upcoming podcast, an upcoming show that that we have. Well, I thought we'd get to our guest early today, and then we will come back and talk about some more in-depth on some economics. We'll talk about some stocks that are important to take a look at and a few other things that I think that you're going to want to hear. Our guest today is Jim Rogers, legendary investor that co-founded the Quantum Fund and retired at the early age of 37. He's the author of several investing books and a renowned financial commentator worldwide, famous for his contrarian views. He's also written, A Bull in China, Smart Streets, Adventures on the Road and in the Markets, Investment Banker, Adventure Capitalist, and you have a new book coming up, which we'll tease in a moment that I think is coming out at the end of this month. So how are you?
I'm fine. But I don't know about the book coming out at the end of the month.
No?
No.
That's not you? Lighting the World? That's not you?
No. I don't know. I'd never heard of it.
I got to find that one.
If it's mine, I don't know about it.
Bad information there, huh?
My last book was Street Smarts, but that's been out a while now.
I thought it was a bit of a turn in a different direction when I was looking at it, to be honest with you. Anyway, let's talk a little bit about what's going on. I did look at some of the things you've recently been talking about and writing about, and some of the things I think more recently was the whole idea is that people are going to be continuing or moving away from the U.S. dollar. Tell me a little bit about your thoughts on that.
Well, there's a little question about that. The U.S. I should quickly say that my largest currency position is the U.S. dollar. I own a lot of U.S. dollars. But having said that, the United States is the largest debtor nation in the world, the largest debtor nation in the history of the world, as a matter of fact. And the debts are getting higher and higher and higher. So you're going to see eventually that people are going to move away from the dollar. They're already looking for alternatives. They're looking for something to compete with the dollar. You know, there's a new Asian bank which will compete with the World Bank and the IMF. So people are looking for ways to compete with the dollar, as they should. I mean, as I said, it's the largest debtor nation in the history of the world. And every country in history that's gotten itself into this kind of situation winds up with a crisis or a semi-crisis. And we will, too. I don't particularly like saying it, but we will, too.
So is this also due to the fact that are you concerned about the amount of debt that we have due to the whole QE? Is it just the debt that we've built up over time? Is there something has changed, do you think, or something is going to change?
Well, no, it's been going on for several years, unfortunately. People in Washington talk about the debt, and they all decry and bemoan the debt, but none of them do anything about it. The few that talk about it certainly don't do anything about it, and the rest of them just continue to spend money and assume it's going to be okay in the end. No, this is an ongoing process. It happened with the British 100 years ago. It happened with the Spanish and the French and the Dutch and many other countries that have been on top of the world financially. They all eventually got overextended, and you know the rest of the story.
Yeah, and you know what? We could look at something I always talk about is when we look at the banking industry, we look at the financial industry in the U.S. and around the world. What happened was they got themselves in a big pickle, of course, as we know, years back, and who bailed them out was the governments, the central banks. And when the central banks started pouring money into not only to fill the hole of this massive debt implosion, they also were filling the hole of trying to prop up economies. And so I always thought, well, you basically transferred all this debt and all this problem to the government. Who, if the government fails, is going to be there to bail them out? And the man above, it seems, is the only one. I mean, there's nobody left, right?
Well, that's going to be the problem. I'm afraid that the next time we have financial crisis or problems, it's going to be centered on governments because of what's happened to governments in the last since the last financial crisis. You know, we had a big problem because of debt, but it was mainly private debt last time around. But this time around, I mean, the Federal Reserve's debt alone has gone up by six times just since 2008. So you're going to see how much the rest of all of the central banks and governments have increased their debt. They printed staggering amounts of money. So I'm afraid the next crisis is going to center in government debt markets, whether it's ours or somebody else's. It'll probably start with somebody else's. It's already maybe starting with the Greeks. We're going to see more problems in the government debt market. And as you point out, uh-oh, what do you do then?
Right.
I mean, who's there to bail out the Federal Reserve? Who's maybe Congress could bail out the Federal Reserve, but who's going to bail out Congress?
Yeah, it goes round and round. I'm not a big fan of this, but what about like these alternative currencies? So, you know, what one thing you're talking about is, okay, well, you know, there's going to be a problem in governments and who knows where that flows to. And there's such an interrelation right now with governments. What about like this Bitcoin or other alternative types of currencies? Is that something that has any legs?
Well, I don't know. Two points about things like that. One, we've just discussed that the world does need something to compete with or maybe even eventually replace the U.S. dollar. And we do know that the computer, call it what you will, the internet, is replacing a lot of things, competing with a lot of things, so it may very well be something, some kind of electronic money. That's very likely, given that the electronics or the computer or the internet is replacing everything else. But I don't see any specific one on the horizon at the moment, other than the fact that the world needs something and somebody may innovate. I don't know if it'll be Bitcoin or not. I doubt it, but who knows? It could be.
Mm. Now, one of the things, I mean, the alternative currency concept, again, I don't want to keep beating on this point, but it does take us to the next point, which is, you know, if governments are going to have problems and if currencies will start to get devalued, which they are, but we've all seemingly devalued at the same time, so it kind of keeps a constant going. The alternative was always, you know, like hard metals. And we've seen this, even though the dollar has gone up, gold has been just brutalized, silver, killed, copper, you know, you name it. I think you either have a gold position or you like gold. I think you do have a gold position, right?
Well, I do own gold and I do own silver. I have hedged some of both, given that I don't think we've seen the bottom in gold or silver yet. You know, gold went up 12 years in a row, which is an anomaly. Very, very few things in world history have gone up 12 years without a down year. Gold did. So the correction is continuing, and it also will be an anomaly, if you ask me. If gold goes under 1,000 or 900, I hope I'm smart enough to buy more.
Hmm.
But at the moment, I'm not buying.
Yeah. And you know, obviously, you know, the entirety of the commodity complex has been under a tremendous amount of pressure. Do you think by looking at that, I know you do look at these things, is there any particular commodity that is being unjustly beaten down?
Well, in my view, agriculture is where the best opportunities probably are at this stage, because agriculture has been a disaster for 30 years. It's been so bad we're running out of farmers. The average age of farmers in America is 58 now. In Japan, it's 66. In Canada, it's the oldest in recorded history. In Australia, it's 58. In the UK, the highest rate of suicide is in agriculture. Millions of Indian farmers commit suicide. I mean, it's been a terrible business for a long time. More people in the U.S. study public relations than study agriculture. So we've got a crisis developing in agriculture. I mean, it's not going to happen this year, but obviously something has to happen, or we're not going to have any food at any price or any clothes at any price.
Nobody wants to get their hands dirty anymore, it seems.
Exactly right.
You know?
We all want to go into the investment world.
And not only that, we don't want to know what we're eating. You know, some people, I find it really humorous, just a side note, you know, I go out with somebody and we eat and maybe they have, let's say, a whole fish is served on the table, okay? And let's say they have a hamburger. Somebody has a hamburger, somebody has a whole fish. Oh my God, there's a head on it. Right, you know, they freak. Oh my God, there's a head on that fish. Meanwhile, the guy's just chewing down that burger, thinking, "I don't know what it is. It's a burger. I don't really know where it came from. I don't know what it's made from. It's a burger. I'm happy with it." You know, we kind of have this a bit of a numbness when it comes to food. But you know, I mentioned earlier that I was traveling in China and I took one of the high speed trains south, and it was about a 3.5 hour run. And before that, I was in a couple of cities, and I was wondering to myself before I got on the train, where's all the farmland? You know, because there's a lot of people in China, obviously. You know, where's all the farmland? You know, where's all the food? And as I was traveling on this train going through the towns, the incredible amount of fish farms and various farmlands, it was just, it stretched, I mean, just for 3 hours on the train. And it's interesting to note that I think that the population of the world is not slowing down, but yet people have to eat. And the whole point of agriculture is something that's obviously going to stay with us. We don't have to have public relations, right? We have to have food.
And clothes, yes. Yeah. There's no question about that.
Well, we don't
have
to have clothes.
Well, we don't have to, but we always have.
It's more fun without clothes.
Yes, well, like I said, yes, but there are not that many nudist colonies left in the world, so you're right. But you make a good point. In China, I'm bullish on agriculture for the reasons we just mentioned, but I'm especially bullish in China because the government now in China has decided that they have to give incentives to the farmers and to the countryside. As they say, you know, for the past 35 years in China, the cities, the people in the cities have done extremely well, but the people in the countryside have not. So they're now emphasizing and giving incentives to the countryside. So while I'm bullish on agriculture, I'm really bullish on Chinese agriculture.
Interesting. It would make sense. And by the way, those people can eat. And I get some good stuff. The meals are not small, and they spend the evening. It's kind of an event. Whereas here, we're just in and out of somewhere, grab a quick dinner, get out, you know, during the week. Seems there it's more of an event. Actually, Asia is more of an event. Let me switch over to something. So recently we've seen some world issues like this Greece situation that happened that dragged out forever and probably was in my lifetime. I've been around in this business for, I don't know, 25 years. In my lifetime, I've never seen such a botched and amateurish event ever that I can remember, at least, that I can remember. But we saw that go on for a number of months, and then all of a sudden one day it's resolved when it's like, okay, you know, even though it's not. Remember the Ebola outbreak that hit us for, I don't know, 3 weeks? People were just freaking out. Yep. It seems that all these things have become very transitory, very quick moving. They happen, and then everybody believes, oh, it's just transitory, it's just going to end soon. And that I wonder if because of all the government intervention, there's something else that lies beneath this, because we're becoming very, I think, I guess I would say either numb or just not involved in this. A good example of what also is happening is when we have, for example, you probably followed this, in South Korea, the recent was a MERS outbreak. And that was a big problem for travel, for tourism, for businesses there, right? This big problem. South Korea actually dropped their discount rate, their main rate. Because they said it. They said, we're going to cut our rate because of a slowdown due to the MERS outbreak. You remember this?
Yes, 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 of course.
And I'm thinking to myself, I don't recall a time in my life that a central bank would cut due to a health issue. It was nutty.
Yes, you're exactly right. These days, everybody thinks central banks can do anything and save the world, no matter what the problem. We're all going to regret that eventually. I just want to, before we get into that, I want to go back to Greece. The Greece problem is not over. You know, it's been going on for 5 years, and every periodically it erupts again, and then all of a sudden it's all solved, and don't worry, everything's okay now. And then it comes back again. Greece is coming back again. We haven't solved the Greek problem, and it is physically and humanly impossible for the Greeks to pay off their debt. They never will. And so this is going to be a recurring problem. Don't think it's over.
Yeah.
But we're also going to have recurring problems with other countries, too, going forward. And we're getting to the point that central banks, while people do still have confidence in central banks, we're eventually going to realize, oh, my gosh, these guys don't know what they're doing. They can't solve the problem. And then, as we were talking before, the next crisis is probably going to be a crisis of government debt and government capability. Because they're not very competent. I'm glad you pointed out about Greece, but I mean Greece and Korea and others. But there are going to be plenty of problems coming up that they cannot solve.
Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of just to stick with the commodity discussion for a moment, oil has been through an incredible ride. You know, from when Goldman Sachs said $200 a barrel to the panic of we're going to run out, to just a quick few years later, so much oil that we don't know what to do with it. And right now, oil's hovering, give or take, on WTI, let's call it 45, let's just for a number. Is that the end of this? Are we going back down to 30? The whole, is it because of the situation between Iran, China, U.S. frackers? I mean, really, what's the bottom line to all this?
Well, first, normally when you have a big drop in anything, there's a bounce, a dead cat bounce, as it's often referred to. But then it goes, whatever the item, it goes back and tests the bottom. You know, it retests the lows. So that's what's going on now. We are testing the lows. I suspect that the lows will hold, whether it goes slightly below or slightly above. It doesn't really matter, because the essential fundamentals of oil continue to get worse. I mean, the whole world is consuming more oil than it is producing, and except for fracking, of course. But fracking cannot make much money at $45 oil.
Right.
So you're going to see more problems as the world's reserves continue to decline. Whether oil goes to 40 or doesn't really matter, I don't think. But we are in the process of making a complicated bottom sometimes this year or next, in my view.
And you take the long approach, which I like. You know, it's not, let's trade it today for tomorrow. It's a bit of a longer approach that you take when you do your thinking and your analysis and your investing, right?
Well, yes. That's because I'm too lazy to be a short-term trader, and I'm not good at it. I'm not good at it, so I don't even try.
Yeah, I hear you. So tell me, you know, you're a lot of times people, and I think maybe you've said it, you're a contrarian investor. You have contrarian views on the financial markets. First of all, can you explain what that is and give me an example of what would be a contrarian view these days?
Well, there are plenty of contrarian views. And by the way, I don't sort of, yes, people call me a contrarian, but what I've learned is if you find something that's cheap, first of all, it's because everybody's ignoring it, and therefore, when I find something cheap, it's first of all, people are ignoring it. Second of all, if I can find change taking place in something that's cheap, I like to pile in. Now, that turns out to be contrarianism, but that's the way I invest, and whatever success I've had, that's one of the reasons. Let's see, what's North Korea? I'm wildly bullish on North Korea, for instance. North Korea today is where China was in 1980. It is changing very dramatically and very quickly. If you listen to American propaganda, of course, you don't get that view at all.
Mm-hmm.
What else is going on?
What about Cuba? How about Cuba? That fits into that category, possibly.
Well, Cuba, yes, although it's getting publicity now that it's, you know, America's now reestablished relations with Cuba. They haven't reestablished relations with North Korea. They won't even let you talk about North Korea in the U.S. But Cuba, no, definitely it's opening up. The problem, I mean, Cuba only has 9 or 10 million people, so I don't consider it to be a great haven in the future.
Yeah.
Iran would be a better example, where we're starting restarting relations with Iran, and Iran has 70 or 80 million people with a long, long history of at times it's been one of the great countries in the world. So yes, it's I would be more interested in looking at Iran than Cuba at this stage.
You know, it's funny because I have some friends that I live in Florida. So I have some friends that, people from Cuba, but are very bullish on the whole Cuba thing, right? You know, that this is going to be the next, you know, they come up with some scenario that's going to be I said to them, yeah, there is only 10 million people there, small little island. I said, what is the industry there and what is going to be the industry that you're so excited about? Well, an entire infrastructure has to be built. I said, yeah, but it's a small little place. I get that there has to be an infrastructure, but it's just an island. And they said, well, telecommunications, fiber optics and all that. I said, but still, beyond maybe a company that will implement fiber optics and internet and things of that nature, is it that miraculously we're going to have workers working for – and what are they going to do? I mean, is it going to be skilled workers? Is it going to be just tourism? And if it's just tourism, you know, what's that? The shipping line, you know, the ships, the airlines. I just don't see the whole massive excitement about Cuba.
Well, neither do I. As I say, if I'm looking around the world for places to invest, Cuba doesn't jump up on my radar screen. Russia is another place where I'm bullish on Russia. Russia is gigantic, as you know, the largest physical country in the world with huge natural resources, very little debt, a convertible currency. I'd much rather look at, you know, places like Iran or North Korea or Russia than Cuba, but to each his own.
Yep. So, but Russia has its, I mean, Russia has a lot of problems, obviously, you know, because of their, well, it just, they do. But they do have, I mean, if, obviously, if commodities come back, that market roars back.
Yes. But even if, as I said, if oil is in the process of making its bottom, then Russia, too, is probably in the process of making a bottom.
Right.
And there are companies in Russia that will do. I'm a director of a fertilizer company in Russia, and the fact that the currency is down is actually good for the company. They sell outside of Russia. Many of their products are sold outside of Russia. So with the fact that the ruble is down helps them. There are opportunities in Russia, even with the price of oil down, and down a lot.
Now, with your thinking about, you know, you have some very, I would call them simple, nothing, I don't mean this in a disrespectful way, but you have a simple ideas on, like, agriculture, why we need agriculture. It's kind of, like, obvious. You know, some natural resources, countries that are being accepted, and maybe a change in the entire process of relations with the world. I mean, those are big picture. Those are big picture things, right? So I think that, you know, that's, you know, an important thing to look at. You know, the idea of, what about the idea of healthcare? That means, I would think that would be something that you would also be very interested in, because all of the recent findings and the new breakthroughs and all the things that are helping people live longer, is that something that you're interested in?
Well, yes, you're exactly right. But on the other hand, I'd rather get involved with healthcare in China, where there's an even more desperate need. There's a bigger market, and the government has said, the government has listed a few things that they're going to put a lot of emphasis on, and one of them is healthcare. So the opportunities are bigger in China than they are in the U.S. I mean, everybody in the world is in healthcare, as you know, and we spend more on healthcare than just about anything. And it's become very, very expensive in the U.S., and we're not getting much to show for it. We don't live longer than other people. Our life expectancy is actually not even in the top 20 anymore, I don't think. So I'd rather look for opportunities in healthcare elsewhere, where the need is greater and the emphasis is even bigger.
Yeah, you know what the other thing maybe I could share this with you, that I've noticed from my travels throughout Europe, Asia, and I've traveled many of the countries there, okay? There seems to be something that always, it sticks out and I can't help it, okay? It may sound weird, but I'm going to tell you. They have terrible teeth.
Yeah. Yes,
terrible.
I know.
You know, you think that, man, let's start a dental company or at least something and bring it on over there. It would be, like, you know, amazing. Maybe an orthodontics chain or something. Or the problem is that obviously we'd have to price it right. But don't you think that dentistry is something that's sorely missing over there?
There is absolutely no question about that. But that, you know, all healthcare, not just dentistry, but dentistry is very, very obvious, especially as they become more prosperous and people care about how they look. They care about what they eat. They care about what they wear. So, yes, no. Dentistry's got a great future in China and in Asia.
Mm. So now you're out of Singapore. What's the word there? The hawker stalls are awesome. You know, they're having trouble at the casino a bit, but still business is booming over there, right?
Yes, Singapore is doing well. Many things going for it at the moment. If the world is slowing down, I know Singapore is going to be affected. The last time we had a slowdown, Singapore came through, as did China, fairly well, but partly because they both have saved up a lot of money for a rainy day. So the last time we had a rainy day, they started spending the money. Mm. That's what they saved it for.
Mm-hmm.
And so Singapore and China came through much better. This time around, I mean, there is more debt everywhere, including in Singapore. Not that significant, but no, Singapore will certainly be affected the next time we have a problem, just as will China. China's got more debt now. They didn't have much debt the last time. Now there's more internal debt in China, so they will be affected more this time.
I tell you, the other thing about China is the ghost cities, which you've seen, are real. I didn't realize how they permeate the entire major towns. You know, the ones that I was in Chengdu and I was in Xi'an and others, but those two particular ones, the ghost cities, they were frightening. The amount of building that has gone on there, but also their recent foray in trying to manipulate markets by actively participating and now shunning, certain investors. Citadel was asked to not participate anymore, or they were banned. Short selling, it looks like there's a witch hunt for short sellers. You know, China's got, I think it was $19 billion from a variety of brokerage firms to say, hey, invest in the markets. You know, they're trying to prop this whole thing up. I just don't see that as being the best idea ever. Do you?
No. I'm quite vocal, just like you. I think it's a mistake. Any kind of artificial bottom is unstable, and anytime the government steps in to make a bottom, it's unstable, and in the end, you have more problems than before. The good bottoms are the ones where they totally collapse. It finds its own natural real bottom, and then you can start over. No, I've certainly been very vocal that this is a mistake that the Chinese are making. Mm.
Well, Jim Raj, I want to thank you for coming on and spending some time with us. And again, we'll have all the books that you wrote, not the wrong ones, on the show notes for this episode. And I'll speak to you soon. Thanks so much for joining us.
Very good. Thank you, Andrew.
Thanks, Jim.
Bye-bye.
Now, that was interesting. That was fun. Let's, as we talked about before we got to our guest, Jim Rogers, I wanted to mention that there was a good amount of economic numbers that came out. And I thought we'd get a little bit more in depth into what we saw last week. So the latest information from the Labor Department, as I mentioned, had shown that employers hired about 215,000 workers in July. Now, a lot of them, 77,000 of them, were professional, business, education, and healthcare occupations. So that was kind of interesting. There was fewer, I guess, government jobs that we did see. We did see a 5.3% unemployment rate. The monthly total hirings averaged now 235,000 since May, compared to about 195,000, just under 200,000 in the first quarter. And that's kind of interesting, where we're probably going to see that the Fed has a very positive view of this, meaning that the potential for a rate increase, at least a small one, at the September meeting is going to go ahead as planned. Now, I also mentioned that we did see that in that report, wage growth was not very impressive, but there was a better amount of personal spending that was seen in, since June and in July. Now, one of the things was really interesting last week. You did see that the ISM service sector, this is the component, it's a big component of the U.S. economy. Some say that about 70% of the U.S. economy is related to the service sector. And the ISM came in at 60.3, which is clearly the highest mark in the 7-year history since the ISM has been putting out these numbers. Now, the factory numbers, the manufacturing number, lost about 0.8 points, came down to about 52.7, which was kind of interesting. Because we're seeing a disparity. We're seeing that manufacturing is slowing, but services are expanding. So manufacturing is slowing, meaning that people are possibly not spending as much on goods, not services now. I'm talking about goods. And the potential is that we do see that, of course, that is a slowdown in exports, because the dollar is been very, very strong of late. And therefore, what's happening is that the manufacturing numbers and the factory numbers are not looking as great. But yet people are spending a lot more when they're here. People are spending a lot more on, I'll call it, restaurants and various services and things of that nature, whereas they're not spending on the goods. So therefore, you can kind of give, I guess, a little bit of credence to the fact that the economy is still slogging along pretty well and people are feeling pretty good, because that's when they spend and they go out and they party and they buy different service-related items. The goods factor, probably I could chalk up a little bit to the fact that foreigners are not spending as much in the U.S. Now, the markets. Let's get down to the markets and what happened last week. I think the big news was that the 7-day loss in a row, consecutive losses for the Dow Jones Industrial Average, which lost about 1.8% for the week. S&P went down about 1.2. NASDAQ was down about 1.65. The worst situation in the markets overall were clearly the commodities. We're still seeing a major fall in many of the areas. Oil lost 6.3%, which is pretty unsettling. Gold actually held on pretty well, it did hold from where it was, did come back and bounce back from the lows, did decline, though, about 0.25% for the week. But the oil situation is still very concerning, and as we do see that oil is falling, we're not seeing as quick of a fall for gasoline prices, which is not so great because, of course, the lower gasoline prices are put more money in people's pockets. The price of oil and the lack of a total correlation to prices of gas are a little bit disturbing, but eventually they'll catch up. They always do. Now, year to date, the Dow Jones is down about 2.5%. The S&P is pretty much flat for the year. I would tell you that from that turnaround that we saw Friday, about 2 o'clock, there was a pretty good spike. And there was some opportunity for the markets to really fall off after the S&P lost major support at the 200-day moving average. That's a pretty key area. That 200-day moving average is a key area that institutional investors, money managers, and possibly even mutual funds, individual investors, they will use that as an area that they will start to pile money in. And we did see that breakdown. It did close at the end of the day on Friday above the 200-day moving average, which is a good sign. It's something good. But there is some concern that how many times can you actually break down this 200-day moving average before, you know, you see a much greater reduction or losses. Now, in the last couple of weeks, we talked about this range, this 2040 number, this approximately 2040 number to the top end of the S&P 500, about 2130. Very wide range, clearly, but this is what's happening. There's a lot of price agreement, which we talked about last week at length, and the fact is that you're going to see this kind of bouncing around for some time. A lot of it has to do with what's going on in the slowdown now in Europe, the potential for an increase in rates in the U.S., and of course, we can't stop stop with that because we do have to mention that China is continuing to slow. The latest readings we saw this weekend again showed that there was a continuation of a slowdown in the Chinese economy. And of course, you did see the newspapers and the media and everybody on wherever else is the media outlets out there saying, well, this is more cause for the Chinese government to add stimulus. The problem is that there is a major divorce of reality, or there was until recently, between the stock market and the economy in China. The idea is that we've seen historically that whenever there is central bank actions, well, there's going to be a great boom in the markets. And in China's case, the central bank has taken a much different role and has the government in not only trying to stimulate the economy, but stimulate the stock market much more overtly and much more directly than we've seen anywhere else. That being the case, the markets took a major run higher. Now, you know that, and we talked about this 100 times now, that what happened was that they made a lot of missteps. Now, there was a great article this weekend in the Wall Street Journal on Sunday, and it was on the Herd of the Street, and it was entitled China's Grip Strangles Shareholders. Now, I don't usually read you things, but I want to kind of go through this article. I thought it was a great summation for many of you who have asked, like, what is really going on in China? So the article goes on to say that China is tightening the screws on the stock market, but that hardly means the edifice it has constructed will hold together better. This week, authorities entered the crackdown phase of the bailout. This includes curbs on short selling, investigations in programmatic trading, and policying of hastily unveiled regulations preventing large shareholders and brokers from selling shares. The relative market calm that has ensued has created a false sense of security among some investors that China will eventually get the hang of the stock market bailout, if it hasn't already. And this is what SocGen is talking about. And they're talking about a lot of things. And one of they said, SocGen saying, hey, you know what? It's Societe Generale says, one of an analyst saying it. Well, you know, the stock market's going to be 40% higher by the end of 2016. Unfortunately, nothing of what the government has done has changed stocks' underlying fundamentals. Apart from banks and other financial companies, China's stock market remains tremendously overvalued. So some, on one hand, they're talking about a 40% rise. On the other hand, they're saying that there's a major overvaluation. So I'm not sure how they reconcile that. Now, they go on to say in this article that If anything, the bailout may simply store up trouble. And it goes on to talk about that the many shares that are acquired by the bankers, the state-backed companies, stockbrokers that are working together are now on their books at artificially high prices. The brokerages whose shares have been battered because of the forced role they have played with the bailout will need to do something with the government at some point. Now, they go again. They continue on and talk about the trading rules that they have in place in China to stop shares moving by more than 10% and the restrictions on liquidity. Also, the things about halting shares, stopping short selling, which we have seen historically has not been good. When you have that, there is halt on short selling or regulations against short selling, like we saw, by the way, in the banks here and the banks and other assets in Europe, as well as the halts that we saw in China, have all backfired. Great article talking about how now all of this and all the things they're trying to do to limit the extent of the fall has done nothing more than prevent liquidity from being available in the market. And that, as the article goes on to say, will make investors want to exit even more. And more important for Beijing's vision of reinvigorating the market, it will dissuade newly ones from joining in any rally. Meaning that they have pretty much crushed the hopes of people that are involved. They have provided a lack of liquidity for major institutions to come in. They have done with their regulations things that probably will prohibit major hedge funds, institutions from desiring to get involved. And new investors and retail investors, particularly in China, are going to be scratching their heads saying, why do I want to get involved in this if there are all these things that I may or may not be able to do? There's a lack of liquidity and we could see these kind of losses. Just one more realization here by me that government interference in markets, even if it is a communist country with state-owned companies with a very direct desire to prop up their markets, in the end, does not work. In the end, there is a major fallout. Now, this one was quick, right? We saw that over about, I'll call it about a year. Over a year's time, we went flying higher and dropped off. There's a run in and a run out. In the United States, we're talking about the bond market, which has so far weathered any kind of storm that you would have thought would have been there with the potential for a rising interest rate environment, or what Jim Rogers has talked about, which is the incredible amount of debt that we have now outstanding and the potential problems that we have with that. It's almost like, you know, okay, everybody's bad, so this is bad, and we're just going to kind of let it go because, what are the alternatives? When is the day of reckoning going to happen like we have seen with the China markets? I don't know that answer. But I'll tell you something. It's inevitable. I can hardly imagine a time when all these things that go on by artificially propping up markets, whether they're bonds or stock markets, can actually work long-term with the devices that have been used. With artificially bringing down the value of your currency, with pumping in money that you don't have from the right pocket to the left pocket, and back from the left pocket to the right pocket, I just don't see any kind of way out of this situation when you are, over a period of time. Yeah, temporarily, short-term, no problem. But really, long-term? To be a permanent solution? Doesn't make any sense. Now, I mentioned a stock that I wanted to bring up, kind of switching gears here for a second. I got to do a little bit more research into this. We looked at this, didn't find anything very significant in terms of news, other than the fact that there seems to be a mass exodus right now. Stock is Sun Edison, symbol S-U-N-E. We bought a little bit of it on Friday just to kind of get into it to see if there was going to be a halt to the massive trade down that we've seen recently on very significant volume. This is classically what you would call a falling knife. There's no question about that. This is, if you want to know what a falling knife is, you know, don't catch a falling knife because what happens is it'll rip right through your hands and make you bleed and you know, do a lot of damage. This is probably a very good example. Could be the poster child. For whatever reason, there was a break in the news that there was the a concern over some of the acquisitions that were being made and the lack of ability for the company to manage them and a few other things that went into play that all of a sudden started a mass exodus. Now, a lot of major names that you may have heard of in the hedge fund industry have a lot of shares here. Now, one thing that you'll notice, and if you haven't, I'll tell you about the hedge fund industry, is that sometimes they act as penguins, right? When a penguin, the first one finally jumps in the water, they all jump in the water. And possibly what's going on right now is an unloading by some of the major shareholders for whatever reason. It could be just as simply that there was a major break in the stock price and that just prompted a lot of other positions to say, you know, I don't understand why it is that the stock is going down from the news that we see, from the information that we see, and we're just out. On the other hand, we could also say that, you know, maybe there's something that's unknown right now by the mass markets that somebody else knows, and they're moving out, and the stock is deservingly being hit. And we could probably also say something in between to the effect of, and this is a general comment about when you see a stock moving as it does with the without the news to follow along, that maybe it's something in between that, right? So a combination, a merging of those two ideas, that maybe on one hand, there's a technical break. On the other hand, there could be some information that's coming out. And what you may see is that because of the large holdings of these companies and the large amount of shares that are being held, and the fact that it's summertime, lack of liquidity generally in markets, that maybe there is a exodus that's going on that is overshooting the levels that really should be. Take a look at this. I mean, you'll look at this stock chart. It looks, you know, pretty pathetic. So that's why we took a little bit of a position just as a contrary, just as a, you know, a trading idea that may see a quick pop up. You know, the potential for it to move up 10, 15, 20% very quickly just to recapture some of the recent losses that it didn't get, you know, for the last few days is very high, whether it's a dead cat bounce or, you know, maybe a reversionary trade or possibly even just there was an oversell that went on. But just take a look at that. Again, I didn't see any real news that would make me think anything that was going on that was really that crazy. But something is going on. There's no question about that. But the technicals are telling you that. Fundamentals will follow along. The big question is, what is it and how severe is that situation? Anyway, we have some great guests coming up over the next couple of weeks. I hope you do join us. Make sure that you follow us on iTunes, of course. You can get it there, or you can find it on Stitcher, or you can find us on any podcast directory out there, or just on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Questions, you can email me at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com, or you could send them over to Twitter or follow me on Twitter. Andrew Horowitz, one word, is the Twitter handle. Until next week, I want to thank you for joining me, and I will talk to you then. Have a great week. Have a profitable week.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing. We'll be right back.